Chapter 2. Eton. Summer term, or WAPS as we called it, seemed to have dragged on endlessly. I sat there in a faded deck chair, gazing dreamily at the shimmering greensward which I'd come to know so well. Clop came the sound of Clement Attlee Jr. hitting another four. Though only a Prime Minister's son, he'd managed to fit in quite well with some of the other boys and was regarded as simply othered by the senior co-pre. I suppose that was because he never got wazzed. Footnote, wazzed. Old Salopian for being afraid. See Robert Graves, The Greek Myths. Although he had gronked most of the lower school with his tadger. Clop! Yet another four. I thought of Horace. Jam Victoria tam facilis scrotum non valet. We always beat Harrow anyway. Why bother? I stood up with languid ease. A junior tick came up and, tugging at my flannels, grovelled. "Old Chapman, sir, may I clean your teeth tonight? Oh, please." "Why don't you bugger off, Shagspot?" I replied traditionally, and gave him a sharp clip on the temple with my bat. "Thank you, sir," he sobbed, and traditionally slumped to the ground. Plucky little squit, that young Macmillan. Should go far, I thought. The sun dappled through the copper-tinted leaves of the beeches along Big Wall as I walked back. Lower Downers seemed strangely calm in that light. Far from the sweltering pitch, it stood like an oasis in its granite thisness. The air was still, save for the drone of a distant one-seater. Where was it travelling from? Where to? Did it matter? The smell of freshly mown grass wafted over from far-off Hayes Meadow. The village clock chimed in the distance, and somewhere, miles above our petty earth, a wisp of cloud took flame from the dying embers of the setting sun. They combined to produce an atmosphere so redolent of this type of writing. A faint clop in the distance splintered the fabric of my meditations, a crass intrusion. What the hell, I thought. Just for that, I shall bloody well bogle up Milkla Passage, and if I meet the captain of Montem collecting salt, or some other lobsters bartering in the forecast, I shan't give an oppidan's fart. I cycled past rows of parental Rolls Royces and cheap-looking Bentleys, lower middle Daimlers and Cadillacs, NQOC, footnote, not quite our class. In a few days, I would be in Nice, soaking up the sun at the side of my father's pool while Jenkins hovered by with a tray of vodkatinis. Someone shouted, "Hey, look where you're going!" I looked round to see who it was, and clop! Everything went beige with purple bits round the edges, the acrid smell of burning rubber, a stabbing pain in my shoulder, mists swirling before my eyes, and the distant sound of waves crashing on the shore suddenly stopped. "Would you like another sandwich, dear?" "What?" "They're your favourite, sandwich spread." "So this is Nice?" I look round. Can it be Nice? We are sitting in our Ford Anglia, my father, my mother, and myself on the promenade, and all we can see is rain, grey sky, grey sea, and grey waves crashing over a grey sea wall. "What do you mean, Nice? This is Scarborough." "You do too much reading," says my father. My mother agrees. "It'll do you more good if you eat your tea." "Quite right. You can't get through to him when he's got a book in his hands. What is it, anyway?" "I haven't been reading." "What's that, then?" My father leans over and glances at a few lines of a paperback that lies open in my hands. Unfortunately, he chooses a paragraph in which two centurions are caressing each other in bed. That sort of thing quite obviously did not go down well with the police force in those days. I wobble a little and close the book. It's a history book." "It's a funny sort of history book. Put it away."
"What, dear?" my mother asks.
"Nothing, dear. Put it away, Graham. Don't let your mother see it."
"What is it?" she insists.
I turn to her and explain. "It's called Claudius the God by Robert Graves, a fine historical reconstruction of the life of Claudius, the Republican Roman Emperor, thought of in his time as a pitiful fool, though the reign Mr. Graves describes is far from folly."
"Is it?"
"Hmm," says my father, as he locks the book in the glove compartment.
Graves. Wasn't he born in Wimbledon?" asked my mother.
"No, that was Tim Graves."
"No, it wasn't. You remember the Graves? There was Alf, and he married that Amelia von Rank, the bonny woman. They used to live, above the chemist in Thurbit Street, opposite the Gantlets."
"I never did like the Gantlets, that smelly corgis of theirs. They should have had it put down."
"They should. Pitiful. Its back legs didn't work. Anyway, finish your tea. We ought to go and get that haddock for Mrs. Riches.
There's plenty of time for that later on. Thraxton's doesn't close till 5.
"They're bound to be out of haddock by then."
"We'll get halibut."
"Mrs. Riches especially asked for haddock."
"Haddock, halibut, cod, there's no difference, all fish. Let's just sit here for a bit and enjoy the view."
"It's raining," I say.
"It's bracing."
You should have your window open, lad. Get a bit of ozone into your lungs. Ozone is oxygen in a condensed state, having three atoms to the molecule, O3. What you can smell is rotting seaweed.
Well, it's good for you.
No, it isn't. Don't argue with your father.
It's those fancy books he's been reading. You can't learn everything out of books, my lad.
There's no argument. It's a fact. Stop it, Graham. Come on, we'll go and get the fish.
No, we won't. We'll stay here. Open that window and get some fresh air into your lungs.
My father lights his pipe. The familiar scent of burning rubber fills the car. I cough and open the window, getting a faceful of wind and rain, followed quickly by 2.5 pints of icy North Sea. I think we should go and get the fish.
That ship out there, says my father, is bringing wood from Norway. Coniferous wood, used in the paper manufacturing industry since the late 15th century. The process was originally invented in China by Tsai Lun, around about AD 105. But the first paper mill in England was owned by John Tate in Hartford. The manufacture of continuous lengths, however, was...
Oh, the Tates! Wasn't their youngest walking about with that Valerie Maskell?
No.
Yes, he was. The one that took ballet lessons for her fallen arches.
No. This process was developed by the stationers Messer H and S Fordrinier.
It was her, you remember. She was the one that got all the spots at Secretarial College.
Quiet, Edith. The Fordriniers were assisted in this by Mr. Brian Donkin, an inventor and engineer.
Donkin? Wasn't his step-uncle Stephanie a wholesale poulterer in Peatling Parlour?
No.
Yes, he was. It was their youngest that moved downstairs next door to the chemist in Wimbledon, nearly opposite the Gantlet.
Shut up.
Do you realise that if you look out there on a very clear day, you can't quite see Denmark? And if you look over there, you would almost catch a glimpse of France if it weren't invisible.
Oh, the sea.
I think we should get the haddock.
Will you shut up about that bloody haddock?
Why is it that every bloody year...
Language!
Every year our summer holiday consists of 2 weeks in Scarborough, Filey or Bridlington, sitting in a car in the rain, bickering. Why don't we go to bloody Denmark?
Language! It's the toilets.
What? What toilets? Your father can't bear foreign toilets. But he's never been abroad. Your Uncle Harry was in North Africa during the war, and their toilets... Ugh. But we're talking about Denmark. Their sanitary facilities make ours look primitive.
I suppose you read that in Hygiene in Denmark by Rupert Bloody Graves.
We did promise, Haddock.
Oh, all right, we'll go and get your bloody flaming bloody haddock. The trouble with you two is you don't appreciate the beauties of nature.
We drive off through a moderate to heavy spume.
What's that you've got over there, my father barks.
It's a book, I counter.
What book? Comes his brusque reply.
I, Biggles, by Captain W.E. Graves, I riposte.
Captain, eh? That sounds better,
he re-ripostes, and slams the engine into third. The plane banked sharply to the left as we hurtled downwards, but the Fokker Wolf was still on our tail.
Ah! Zing! Went the twin cowl-mounted Mittelschmerz 25mm cannons. Ping! It went in German, as one of the shells bit into the sleek wooden fuselage.
Ping! Cogitated Biggles. That's German for bang.
We've been hit, volunteered Ginger grimly.
Nothing, said Biggles grimlier,
as he slipped his leather-gloved hand over the by now moistened joystick. He pulled it back in a series of sharp jerks.
Level off, Mo, put in Algy dryly through drawn lips.
He stepped purposely into the body of the aircraft, past the by now shapely nude lady navigator, and back into the rear of the plane. The door of the gent's only sauna hung precariously from one hinge. He slammed it shut with a haunting squawk and fought his way past the two naked waffs wrestling in perfumed sump oil. He erupted into the aft leather room to find Winko still chained to a cross, wearing the by now familiar black hood bearing the also familiar Wing Commanderic braid.
Have your way with me, you hunk of manhood, he hinted coyly.
What ho, old sport, hazarded Algy gingerly.
I say, old man, the group's a bit dashed worried. Thinks you might have some kind of, well, you know, problem, you old bison.
He fingered his cigarette nervously.
Don't worry about me, old tapir. I've pulled through a lot worse than this.
The plane lurched suddenly as Biggles swerved to avoid a hail of bullets that pumped in spurts out of the penis-like nose cone of the pursuing Fokker.
Algy rushed forward. Everything okay, skipper, he admitted.
We haven't made it yet, inserted Biggles. He gritted his thighs and plunged his machine into a savage spin.
As they plunged downwards, the mighty engines throbbed, and the well-lubricated pistons thrust themselves back and forth in their vice-like sheaths. You look a bit green around the gills, old Eland, observed Biggle smoothly. Never felt better, puked Algy. Sorry about the mess, he opined. Why can't you just say things, snorted Biggles. Tell you what, old man, having a bit of trouble with this one, could you just pop your hand down my May West? If it's an order, old Guillemot. It is, grinned Biggles. Right-ho, here it comes. Algy plunged a questing, sensitive hand into the group captain's flying jacket. The plane soared upwards. Don't stop now, I'm nearly there. So am I. Ooh, ejaculated Biggles and Algy together. They were through. The white silence of a cloud surrounded them. What about me? Rasped Ginger. Fuck off a sec. Ooh, oohed Biggles and Algy. Then suddenly they were through it. Peace, calm, ecstasy. They floated as one in a post what can't be described in a children's book sort of feeling. Ginger had missed out again, but he was used to this, and easing himself back into his cold leather chair, mused, to heck with a lot of them. I'll just jolly well sit down here and improve the bally old mind a little, don't you know? Languidly, he cold-chiseled his way through the padlock on his air survival reading kit and snapped the seal of the 2.5mm file containing the tincture of cricket pavilion. He clicked it neatly into the glue-sniffing socket on his oxygen mask and ran his rapidly glazing eyes over the emergency in-flight reading list. The complete works of Captain W.E. Johns. How to speak English in other languages? The Interpretation of Dreams by Sigmund Freud. That's dashed odd, he thought. Hun Yid Lit? Must have a gander. Cautiously, he opened the volume and gasped as he read inside the cover. Happy Bar Mitzvah Algernon, old ocelot. Keep off the pork. Love Aunt Rachel already. What? So that's why Algy always wore his swimming togs in the showers, the flipping bounder. As the subtle aroma of grass clippings, blanco'd canvas and linseed oil swathed his olfactory organs, he flicked through the pages with curiosity. The theories of dreaming and its function. Flick, flick, he went. Symbols in dreams. Sexual symbols in dreams. Sexual symbols in dreams. Maybe. Then thwack. It was as if he had been struck nose before wicket by a cricket box hurled at full stench. Navigational dreams. Spot on. Chocks away, he enthused, and read hungrily on. In the following pages, I shall prove that the entire psychology of man can only be understood with reference to the science of navigation. Quite right, interposed Ginger. I remember a 35-year-old patient whose prepubertal son was having recurrent nightmares in which he would push a raspberry up his left nostril and run into the middle of the lounge shouting pelmets. This caused such embarrassment that his father punished him by making him stand on a window ledge holding a whole punnet of raspberries. They became so heavy that he lost his balance and fell down the face of a huge white cliff in the shape of a gendarme's nose, after which he woke up to find himself inexplicably in the sea at the bottom of a cliff. In later discussions with the boy, it became apparent to him that the raspberries represented raspberries and the cliff was in fact a cliff. But to the psychoanalyst, the cliff is a glaring symbol of a navigational fetish. Man's life is divided into two phases. One, childhood, and two, navigation. Childhood is divided into the following stages. 1. Heavy petting. 1. 2. Coital navigation. 1. 3. Embryonic navigation. 1. 4. Fetal navigation. 1. 5. Neonatal navigation. 1. 6. Infantile navigation. 1. 7. The prepubertal navigational spurt. 1. 8. Pubertal navigational day, and 1. 9. Post-pubertal navigation, the beginning of the marine period, the onset of Regenwettertraum. Footnote. There would appear to be no equivalent in our language for this Viennese peasant word. The nearest would, I suppose, be soggy dreams. At this point, we come to the longer phase, navigation 2, which we may divide with Aesculapius, Galen, Pantagiali, Nietzsche, Marx, Len Dayton, and Hitler's dog into 2-1 at sea, 2-2 on land, 2-3 in the air, 2-4 other places. 2-1 navigation at sea may be divided into the following broad categories. 2-1 alpha on top of the sea, 2-1 beta under it, 2-1 gamma quite close to the sea, but not actually getting your feet wet.
Schul Wasserfusch Bekleidung nicht gestellt. Footnote. This Viennese student pork butcher's slang word literally means, my God, there goes a clever psychoanalyst. It is also an allusion to 12 Bream in My Wellingtons by Horatio Nelson, Admiral, a puzzling title which Freud was later brilliantly to interpret as an obvious apostolic complex, in which Nelson himself plays the Christ figure, Bream representing the early Christian fish symbol, and at the same time an overt corruption of the word dream, quite common in navigational dreams. He was also clearly in love with an as-yet-unborn military rubber fetishist. Freud intended later to expand this footnote into 12 volumes, provisionally entitled Generals, Admirals, Oedipus, Vagina Envy, Fish, Christ, Masturbation, oh, and all sorts of other things like cucumbers, radishes, figs, donkeys, other people's bottoms, gallbladder fixations, teeth, snow, hash, uppers, downers, Bakelite underwear, sports commentators, pole vaulting, and the great Vaseline boom. But sadly, this was not to be. He died, leaving Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber to translate it into the Broadway smash hit Kiss My Twat, an all-goat musical comedy. Beneath Biggles, that's damned clever, he hemopticized, and read on. In relation to this, I remember a 29-year-old female patient whose exactly adolescent son was having recurrent dreams about flying. In one dream, which he was able to recall particularly vividly because he was on a youth hostling holiday in the Lake District, and his red-haired companion in the bunk above him had fallen asleep, dropping a navigational handbook, which spiraled down and struck him on the temple, causing the rapid onset of wakefulness. A fictional aviator called Bigglesworth and his companions are attempting to escape from a Fokker Wolf, which is pursuing them and shooting at them. They are hit somewhere in the back of the plane, and Algy, one of Biggles' companions, goes to inspect the damage. It is not serious. After a routine exchange with a wing commander in the rear compartment of the plane, he returns to the pilot's cabin to report that all is well. There, his group captain is having trouble with his flying jacket, but with Algy's help, manages to sort it out and escape the pursuing Fokker at the same time. A typical dream recall of a particularly exciting episode in an adventure story for boys, or so it would seem. Let us look at the dream more closely. The first thing we notice is that the description is full of overt references to changes in direction. The plane banked sharply to the left. The plane lurched suddenly. Biggles swerved to avoid the pursuing Fokker, an unmistakable symptom of navigational obsessions. Note also the use of zoological terminology in their navigational exchanges with one another. Old bison, old tapir, and even old guillemot, clearly indicating a yearning for a pre-rational animal state of existence in which navigation was not yet distinguishable from simply running around. The boy patient clearly identifies himself with the minor character Ginger, who is excluded from the adventure because he is navigationally inadequate. At this point, Ginger stopped reading. Ginger, he thought? That's me. Inadequate? What a bally awful tome, don't you know, what ho, old chap? He slid back the Bakelite window and grinned through steel lips as he watched the book hurtle in a plinth-defying spiral towards an angry North Sea. Clop! I had been struck on the head, causing rapid wakefulness. The Anglia was now parked outside Thraxted's fish shop with my mother inside, engaged in the purchase of haddock, and my father saying, "You've been bloody reading again." "I haven't." "Well, what's this in my hand?" "Oh, it's the Interpretation of Dreams by Sigmund Freud, probably his most original work, in which he discovered a way of exploring the unconscious and found that neurotic symptoms are like dreams in that they are a product of conflict and compromise between the conscious and unconscious states. He was able to..." "Is it?" he said, as he thumbed through the pages. "What's this?" As a little girl, she remembered her older brother and his friends asking her to remove her undergarments and performing cartwheels, thus displaying her genitalia to their curious gaze. In later life, she...
"I've got the haddock. What were you saying? What's that book?"
"Nothing." The glove compartment opened and closed. "Nothing, just a road map."
Who's Freud, then?"
"He's an expert on navigation. Very interesting. His theories of navigation, you see. Longitude, latitude, that sort of thing."
"Ah, well, that's enough of that. Let's get back to Mrs. Richards with this haddock."
"Right."
Quite a lot happened over the next few years.
A disastrous sexual experiment with Rita Blake, my first love affair with another boy. Stuffing snails into a gatepost with Annette Hoy. The hen-stealing nuns, pig-shit Freeman, Miss Chamberlain's three consecutive head girls pregnant. My questions about ejaculation to a biology master, Anthony Blonde in a book called Health and Hygiene for Secondary School Girls, written by myself and my brother. Albert the groundsman, me holding hands with Mark Collins in a math class, the couple copulating in the French library, painting John Wilder black, who knows Eskimo Nell, Monsieur le Bogue Vapu, purple smoke, little boy's eardrums, this is a raid, and elderly spinsters wanking off birthday cakes. But such trivia needs no elaboration. One childhood is much like another. Amateur psychologists who think it clever to explain the character of the later man for a jumble of largely fictitious memories can ferret for their filth in other people's autobiographies. They have opened the wrong book.